Hello everyone, I'm just about to start the call. I'm going to wait till it's exactly time so that everybody can log in. But it's really fun to see people logging into the call from all over the place. Sacramento, Canada, Wisconsin, Washington, Portland, Beverly Hills, San Mateo. It's so fun to see people logging in. Okay, so welcome everyone. This is our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundation of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. I'll start with a clinical pearl, and then I'll move on to the questions and case studies that have been submitted. You're all muted right now, and if you want to ask a question, then you can just press *7 to unmute yourself. And just please be mindful if you're discussing a case to protect the privacy of your patient. So I'm going to start with a clinical pearl for which you should have the slides. This clinical pearl is about apoptosis and P53 gene expression. So this is about reversing inhibition of apoptosis with natural compounds, which we really started talking about on our last Grounds Round call when I talked about BCL2. And reversal of inhibition of apoptosis. Remember, apoptosis is a strategy that cancer cells use to be immortal. Apoptosis is the normal intelligence of a cell that recognizes itself as aberrant and not viable and self-destructs by various means, one of which is apoptosis, which is a cascade of enzymes and signals. And I want to talk in particular about the tumor suppressor gene, P53. We call this the guardian of the genome, and it actually is mutated in over 40% of all cancers, and you will find that information on a pathology report. If you're curious about it and you don't see it on a pathology report, you can always call the pathologist and ask them to do it. But I always assume that there's some P53 inhibition or mutation when someone has developed cancer because it's so P53 is a gene that is so crucial to control of apoptosis. So basically, apoptosis is, there's a signaling mechanism for it. We looked at BCL2 last time, but P53 is unusual because it's actually active in multiple parts of the cell. And so I have a little slide that shows that. But really what you want to understand is that this is a functional protein that is a signaling transcription factor. And when the cell is recognized as having damage to its DNA or damage to its mitochondria, then a series of cascade of reactions should happen to trigger apoptosis or autophagy, self-digestion of a cell. And so remember that this happens in the inner membrane of the mitochondria and DNA and in the cytosol as well. And P53 acts in all these different partitions of the cell. And so let's just look at this slide that shows the P53 DNA repair and apoptosis. So if you have it in front of you, DNA damage will happen, P53 will become activated, and this cell will either repair, there's a pause button that signal that's sent by P53, and the cell will either repair its damage and then go on to replicate, or it will have apoptosis initiated and the cell will then self-destruct. So the next image is an infographic that was in our BCL2 slide, but in this one, you can see all the places where P53 is active as well. And so lots of places in that inner mitochondrial membrane. The inner mitochondrial membrane is extremely sensitive to oxidative stress. So whenever there's oxidative stress, there's a potential that the cell and the mitochondria are going to have damage. and that P53 then will be expressed. But if it's mutated, it won't be expressed, and then these stop signals really never happen. So in the presence of oxidative stress, we get P53 expression. That can lead to necrosis, apoptosis, and the apoptosis can be happening in all these compartments that I just mentioned. And then autophagy can also be triggered. So there's a number of ways that cells will self-destruct, but it requires a signal. And one of those primary signals is the P53. And what happens is similar to what we talked about in the BCL2, is that intermembrane of the mitochondria will all become depolarized. And as that happens, then these other enzymes become activated, or permeability changes. And so the cell then goes through a series of reactions of caspase activation. That's the series of enzymes. And then the cell destructs. And so what we want to do is promote that. And so I've given you a slide that shows natural compounds that actually serve to normalize P53 function and promote normal function. Remember that when a gene is mutated, usually it's not 100% mutated. And so there is still something to salvage and some support to be given for normal function. And so a lot of our commonly used botanicals and nutraceuticals have a very positive impact on promoting normal P53 function, thereby promoting both repair mechanisms as well as triggering apoptosis. And so curcumin and turmeric curcuma longa fall into this category. Interestingly, ginseng falls into this category, the ginsenosides. And if you think about how ginseng has been used historically in China, it's a longevity herb. So it's possible that one of the things it does is it really normalizes P53, so aberrant cells self-destruct, so disease happens later. I heard a really interesting lecture yesterday by an integrative geriatric doc, and he studies people in the blue zones where there's a really long, healthy life and longer life. A lot of people become centenarians, and it's not that they don't get the same diseases that lead to end of life in humans. They just get them later, and they have a better quality of life. And so there was the subset of the wealthy Chinese that had access to the best ginseng. So maybe that's part of how it works. We have resveratrol in this category. We have green tea and EGCG in this category. Ginger is in this category. The withanones from Withania somnifera, which is ashwagandha. Ramania, which is one of the great Chinese herbs for supporting the kidney qi, that's filled with polysaccharides. And remember, polysaccharides also trigger immunity. We have Ganoderma or reishi mushroom. And we have Coriolis versicolor, the polysaccharides in that. That is turkey tail. And Coptis chinensis is very rich in berberine. So a lot of things that we talk about in the course and in our treatment plans. And when I skipped over rhabdosia, which has oridonin in it, which is a very powerful phytochemical, particularly studied in prostate cancer. But you can see, as always, botanicals are multitaskers. And we know that these phytochemicals and botanicals also have other functions in the context of health and longevity, but also in the context of the cancer terrain and signaling. I want to bring your attention also to the fact that 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, the active form of folic acid, also is involved in normal P53 function. So if you have someone with an MTHFR mutation, they may have more trouble having normal P53 function and protecting that gene. And also tocotrienols, which are an amazing form in the vitamin E family that I'm just starting to study really extensively because it has so many functions in the cancer setting. And so I'm going to do a clinical pearl on it. But in this context, I want to bring to your attention that tocotrienols also have this function. And so that's what I want to emphasize in this clinical pearl today, that paying attention to P53 is super important because its impact is so wide and pervasive in cancer, and that we have a toolbox with which we can support more normal function there. Remember that one of the goals when you have tumor mass is to reduce your tumor mass, but another goal is to turn apoptosis back on. Remember that one of the hallmarks of cancer is resistance to apoptosis. So one of our clinical goals in our treatment plans is to include some substances that will help normalize P53 function. So I will just stop there. If you want to ask a question, hit *7. And then after that, I'll go on to some of the questions, and then we'll do the case study. Anybody have a question? Nope, that was pretty straightforward. All right, so there were a lot of questions and this month. And so, you know, as our community gets bigger, there's more and more questions. So Anna asks, and it's Anna's case we're going to go over it later. Anna asks, with the popular influx of wide options of IV therapies for cancer treatments offered by multiple clinics, have you found that not providing IV therapy has limited options for your patient, has influenced the therapeutic plan of action, and has limited the efficacy of the art and science of cancer care? Isn't that beautifully asked? In other words, how important is IV therapy in today's cancer care programs? Do you collaborate with clinics who do offer IV therapy? So I'm really a big fan of IV therapies. Because I'm a doctor of oriental medicine and acupuncture, I don't have that scope of practice, but I do have a colleague who is an osteopath here in Los Angeles who also is deeply trained in integrative cancer care, and she does IV therapies for my patients when I want them to have it. She'll also write prescriptions for things that require a prescription. For example, if we wanted to do oral copper chelation with a compounded drug called tetrathiomolybdate, or if I wanted my patient to take metformin or something like that, then she will do that for my patients, and we're a good team together. Now, I never used to do IV therapies with my patients because I didn't have anyone I really felt comfortable with. This doctor has two nurses on staff. There's a crash cart in the clinic, and it's a very safe place for people to have IV therapies. There's all these pop-up IV therapy centers happening, and I'm not sure they're all really, truly medically safe for patients. So I'm pretty careful where I refer. And so I do think that IV therapies have a place. I'm just going to give you a high altitude view as a way to think about it. I'm not really qualified to teach it because I don't practice IV therapies. So if there's a lot of interest, I can bring in Dr. Gisler or Paul Anderson, who are masters of those therapies in the cancer setting, to do a talk for us. So if you have interest in that, you can email us and let us know. But here's how we think about IV therapies. There are cytotoxic therapies, and those would include IV vitamin C, IV curcumin, IV artesunate. There are sort of non-specific immune modulating therapies, such as IV or sub-Q mistletoe therapy, which has been done in Europe for decades and decades. Kind of like the combination of those two, doing something cytotoxic and doing something immune modulating, because then that kind of fills two niches in a good therapy plan. There are other IV therapies that are done. I like to play safe, so I tend to just stick with ones where there's lots and lots and lots of experience and data. Some people are doing NAD intravenously, and I have seen remarkable things happen with it, but it can be dangerous in some people. So I put a reference article for you there. And then also there are clinicians who, after they do the therapies, they might do like a repletion, or after chemo might do an IV repletion, like with a Myers cocktail, or you can do omega-3 fatty acids or glutathione. Somebody has really, really bad cognitive impairment or neuropathies, you could think about doing IV phosphatidylcholine. So there's lots of IV therapies that people are very deeply trained in. And so I think it's good for us to know about it if we ourselves aren't trained in it and doing it, because I think of it as a way to sort of do mild chemotherapy. So once the tumor burden has really been reduced, one of the things I like to do is have a long-term plan to scavenge microscopic cells. So I'll have my patients do maybe 3 or 4 times a year, do a several weeks of intensive IV vitamin C and also take oral cytotoxic herbs at the same time. And thereby, if a patient's NED, no evidence of disease, thereby hope to scavenge some of the microscopic cells and some stem cells, which are both are the sources of recurrence. And so that's what I do kind of as an insurance policy. Now, some people use IV therapies as primary therapies or in between their chemo infusions. So if you're on a 21-day chemo cycle, you could, during week 3, do an IV therapy. IV artesunate is also very cytotoxic. We're going to talk about artemisinin later in this call. So you can just think about those things, but it's very expensive. So not every patient can do it, because it could be several thousand dollars a month to do IV therapies. It also takes a lot of your time. These infusions can take several hours, and they usually are administered several times a week in the cancer setting, which is very different from doing just nutritional repletion. One of my colleagues, Keith Block, who's an integrative oncologist in Chicago, after people have chemo, he repletes them with nutrients a couple of days later. So that's another way to think about it. So I think that IV therapies are a very powerful, powerful tool. IV ozone, running the blood through ultraviolet light. There's all kinds of therapies. There are a number of docs in LA who are very experienced. Dr. Cynthia Watson's on this call. She does IV therapies in her office. And one of our friends, Dr. Alan Green, does a wide variety of IV therapies. So if there is an experienced doctor in your community, then I would look to cultivate collaborative relationships. Cynthia, do you want to say anything? Oh, looks like she dropped off. All right. Anyway, she's a colleague of mine who's in the class. Looks like she dropped off. All right. So that's my answer to that. Yes, I think it's super valuable. Can we do a lot without it? I used to never do IV therapy. So whatever you can do and whatever that patient can afford, you know, look at all the options, look at all the tools and see which ones make the most powerful treatment plan for your patient. All right. So Stacy DeAndre, who is an oncologist, asks, can you please discuss the possible anti-cancer properties and other benefits and thoughts on fucoidin supplements as an adjunctive treatment for certain cancers? So I have never used fucoidin. That doesn't mean it's not of value, but where I sort of land and what I'm teaching all of you is the things that I see are the most used among the integrative oncologists who get the best results. So I'm looking at their treatment plans. I think a couple of things govern our choices. One is, do we have a good source available? So when we are looking at phytochemicals, or in this case, a seaweed-derived phytochemical, then we want to make sure we have a clean, reliable source for that. Certainly there are supplements. But again, the really main supplement companies, I don't know any of them that make a fucoidin product. So it would be a smaller company that's a niche company that has a specialty product like this. So we'd have to vet it, right? So I don't have any experience to speak from, Stacy, but I did do some sleuthing and research for you, and I found some really nice summary notes and references on the Memorial Sloan Kettering site. They have a lot of references, and so those I gave you a link for. I also looked at the typical dose range, so it's about 88.5 to 350 milligrams daily in a number of the papers I looked at in answering your question. Caution, it's high in potassium, so if somebody has kidney disease, then we want to be careful with that. It also is anticoagulant in the literature. I don't know how anticoagulant it is because I haven't used it, but it's present in a lot of seaweeds. And the literature shows that it has anti-tumor, anti-angiogenic, in particular VEGF inhibition and pro-apoptotic properties. reduces cell adhesion, relieves chemotherapy-related adverse effects like gastroenteritis, can have an impact on cancer-related fatigue, has anti-inflammatory control of NF-kappa B, COX-2, TNF-alpha, et cetera. Does impair inhibit the matrix metalloproteinases, which is really important for taking control of proliferation and spread, but also it really protects the blood-brain barrier if you can disable some of those matrix metalloproteins. It reduces tumor-promoting M2 macrophages. I have a lecture on inflammation that talks about the different types of macrophages, and you can have these more tumor-promoting, more inflammatory macrophages in tumor cell lines. Stimulates natural killer cells and downregulates insulin-like growth factor receptor signaling through the PI3K-AKT pathway. So these are all things we want to do. So having said that, I gave you several references that I looked at and I think are good references, along with the list that was on Sloan Kettering's site. I don't see a lot of my colleagues using it. So my mentors don't use it, and a lot of the docs I collaborate with don't use it. So there may be another community of people working in integrative oncology that use it quite a lot. I'm just not aware of them. So that's my rather unsatisfactory answer to your question, Stacy. So it looks good on paper, but why aren't people using it? That would be my question. And I think, you know, as we all explore, we can find lots and lots and lots of things that have good studies on them. A lot of these studies are just cell studies and not human studies. So, you know, I think we have to also discriminate. What do we want to build our treatment plans out of? And what are the big levers? What are the things that are easiest to get that we feel the most confident in? So, I think we all also get in ruts and communities that practice one way. So it's good to pop our heads out and look at what other people are doing. So I'm sorry, I have no experience using it, but due to your question, I learned a lot about it. Stacy also asked, what is the dose of astragalus and marrow plus to use in cytopenias? So, of course, myelosuppression is the result of many, many cancer therapies. And so I use primarily the research on astragalus, which is a Chinese herb called huangqi. It's one of the great cancer herbs in Chinese medicine. It's really incredible for the immune system. One of its gifts is it does really restore natural killer cells and leukocytes and neutrophils. So you have to give pretty big doses of it. I usually use the liquid because my patients just get pill fatigue from everything I'm giving them. So I usually give them about 2 teaspoons of a high quality extract. I usually use Herb Farm or Golden Lotus, and sometimes Wise Woman Herbals. Or you can also use high-quality freeze-dried granules. There are a number of Chinese herb companies that make super high-quality. One of the oldest companies is Sunten, S-U-N-T-E-N. Also, Evergreen Herbs makes really high-quality Chinese products. And some patients will prefer that because they can just put it in hot water. It's easier to travel with. So there's that. And then Health Concerns makes this Chinese herb product in pill form called Marrow Plus, which is basically a copy of a modern Chinese herbal formula that's used in Chinese oncology clinics for myelosuppression. I usually give three times a day. And you'll see that patients just don't crash so far and don't always have the need for Neupogen or Neulasta or whatever being used in your clinic. So I always just, if they're on a myelosuppressive therapy, I just include one of these in their protocol. Most of these herbs are like nourishing type herbs. They don't really interact with drugs very much. If you're uncertain, just look at the duration of action of the therapy, the chemotherapy agents the patient is getting, and then just make a little window. So you initiate these therapies after the action of that activity of the drug is no longer an issue. But I do this really in all patients who have myelosuppressive therapies. You would not give astragalus, however, to a leukemia patient or a lymphoma patient because you could ramp up their disease. You wouldn't give astragalus to somebody with autoimmune disease either. So you, those are the contraindications. Any questions there? Nope. Okay. Then Stacy also has a question. She asked a question about artenamol, which is actually dihydroartemisinin, and it is actually a malaria drug. And the active metabolite of all artemisinin compounds is dihydroartemisinin. And so you can do IV therapies with artesunate. You can do oral therapies. So I use artemisia a lot. So let's just talk a little bit about the mechanism of action. It's used a lot in IV therapies aggressively. If you really want to learn how to use IV therapies of this nature, either study with Paul Anderson, who's a very famous naturopath who teaches. He was in practice for decades doing this. He's a brilliant guy, very good teacher. And there's another guy named Brendan Cochran, who practices in Seattle, and he and Paul Anderson are colleagues, but Brendan also teaches all over the world how to do IV therapies with cancer patients. So if you want to learn that and you want those people's contact information, you can just Google them. They're great docs, really super smart, experienced docs and good teachers. But basically, the mechanism of action of artemisinin is it binds to iron, enters the cell, and creates an oxidative stress event. And so it acts similarly to alkylating agents, that category of chemotherapy agents. For example, those are the platinum drugs, act that way. So and as a result of that, you get apoptosis, cell cycle arrest, and a decrease in angiogenesis via inhibition of VEGF and inhibition of NF-kappa B. So it's really powerful. So because I don't do IV therapies, I do an oral protocol that I learned from Donald Yance, who's one of my mentors. And I put some notes in here about how he does it. But he also feels that artemisinin cells can become resistant to it. So he'll pulse it, either do it every other week or 1 week out of the month. It depends where your patient is in their process. So if somebody is done with aggressive therapies, you're just trying to maintain them, I use the artemisinin along with some oral cytotoxic herbs, which are in the study we're going to look at today, and the IV therapies, you know, a couple times a year in a pulsed fashion to try to reduce any microscopic tumor burden or stem cell burden. But by itself, it is not sufficient. You know, it has a place. If somebody's just, you know, declined all conventional oncology, then you could build a treatment plan out of the oral way that I put a plan together and some IV therapies and hypertherm. You know, you could do it. If you want to really see how that's done in Germany and Switzerland, there are clinics that do that, all simultaneously together. They have patients there in a residential setting, usually for a month or two, and they're treating them intensively. It's extremely expensive. I do have patients who've gone over there who, you know, have been treatment resistant. I like the oral artemisia products that not only have the concentrated phytochemical, the artemisinin in it, but also have the whole plant mixed in it. So you'll see on the label, you'll see artemisinin plus either sweet wormwood or sweet Annie or whole herb extract, you know. So I like to do that so we get the whole spectrum of the plant, not just one phytochemical in it. And so it's mildly toxic, and that's another reason to pulse it. A colleague of ours kind of in the community of naturopaths and traditional herbalists is Jonathan Treasure. He's up in Oregon, and he likes to add butyrate concurrently to his when he's pulsing the artemisinin. He also published something about his dosing and his warnings about toxicity. Particularly, you can get some elevations in liver enzymes if you're getting high doses of it. You should be careful in patients who are vulnerable in that way. And then I also put in Paul Anderson's IV protocol in the notes for you, I put the product that I use. And so all that's in the notes for those people who want to look at doing this. And it's powerful therapy. It's a very powerful therapy. Also gave you a fairly recent paper, a 2018 paper called Anti-Tumor Research on Artemisinin and its Bioactive Derivatives. And it's an excellent paper. And then I give you about 10 other references. But artemisinin has been used in a wide variety of cancers, leukemias, head and neck cancers, colorectal, breast, lung, cervical, gastric, gallbladder, liver, brain. So it has a wide spectrum of activity. So I think it does have a place. My approach is if there is a good conventional therapy for a patient and we have faith and confidence it will reduce their tumor burden, I like to do that because also then insurance will pay for it for that patient. And then keep them in ED with our toolbox and some of, or if somebody becomes treatment resistant, then we want to use some of these more aggressive kind of therapies. So that's how I think about it. And then Stacy also asked, do you have experience with ellagic acid for neutropenia in patients on therapy? Stacy, you ask questions which I don't know stuff about. So I couldn't find a paper on ellagic acid and neutropenia. So if you have one, send it over to me and I'll look at it. But ellagitannins, in my experience and knowledge, ellagic acid is a phytophenol that is in the category called ellagitannins. And there's a lot of research. And ellagitannins are generally red and pink in color. So, for example, raspberries, pomegranates, and strawberries are high in ellagic acid. And you will find, encapsulated concentrations of these. And there is a lot of research on the use of ellagitannins in all kinds of cancers, colorectal, breast, lung, cervical, esophageal, and head and neck, skin, liver, prostate. So lots and lots of studies. And in a lot of our therapies, like in the shake where we use reds and greens powders, there's going to be ellagitannins in that. There's also some studies that show that ellagitannins impact the microbiome in a very positive way, and also help change the microbiome in such that normal detoxification and excretion of estrogen happens and you don't get a recirculation of estrogen back into the system because it gets deconjugated. I did do a clinical pearl on the estrobilome. So if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, there's a whole talk and slides on that in the library. But ellagitannins have a impact on the microbiome and estrogen recirculation and deconjugation. But it's definitely, the ellagitannins are known to be anti-proliferative, anti-carcinogenic, and even chemopreventive. So, but I did not find a study. So if you have one and that is what triggered your question, let me look at it. But again, I don't know any colleagues that use ellagic acid in this way, because I think you'd probably just need a giant dose of it. So it may just be prohibitive in terms of how much you'd have to give to get that kind of impact. That's my suspicion, why it's not used more widely. So if you had a human study and we could look at the dose at work, that would be really great. All right. So that's everybody's questions. So I'm going to pause here and let you ask if you want to comment on any of that, have an opinion or a pearl or yourself, or want to discuss any of those things we just went over. Yes?
Hello, this is Stacey. Yes, Stacey. It is. Yes. Sorry, I build up these questions. I read stuff and I'm like, oh, this is so interesting. It's just hard. There's so much out there. It's
That's
hard
right.
to know what's clinically relevant and what's not. I did find a paper, I think it was on neutropenia in prostate cancer patients on therapy, and I'll have to pull it and I'll send it to you. And so it did seem to help with that. But, you know, there's so much out there, just trying to figure out what's useful.
Absolutely. And I think that I look at that as one of my functions to like be a filter for all of you, because there's too much information out there And so the better question as clinicians is like, what works, right? It actually works. And so, there is a really amazing community of naturopathic oncologists and some incredibly brilliant people. And they have an annual conference every February, and they focus a lot on phytomedicine as well. So that might be another community of clinicians, very experienced, that you might want to also become part of. I go to their conference every year, and Paul Anderson and Brendan Cochran are part of their community, for example. So there's a little background noise. Is that you, Stacey, or somebody else who's unmuted? All right. So send me that paper, because I'd like to look at it. My other comment in response to what you just said is that in estrogenic cancers, in which I include prostate cancer, ellagic acid and pomegranate, you'll see that those are used in those treatment plans. So there may be some crossover there where there's different mechanisms of action that are benefiting the patient. So, Stacey, if you are done talking, just hit *6 to mute yourself. Again, we won't get your background noise that way. Thank you. Okay, anybody else? Nope. All right. So there's a couple of, I always add some papers I think are good for you all to be aware of for a well-rounded perspective and education. Every year there's an annual report to the nation on the status of cancer. It's published by the NCI, and it just was published in May of this year, and I gave you the link of it. It's pretty interesting, has a lot of statistics, and looks a lot at the impact of the environment, interestingly enough. Also, there's a lot of interesting statistics in this one on what's happening in breast cancer patients, and so I put some of that in there for you. There's another paper I linked that's about the proportion and number of cases and deaths attributable to potentially modifiable risk factors in the United States. And, you know, this doesn't get talked about enough in the oncology setting. And I have two nutrition coaches in my practice who I think are both on this call. And this kind of patient teaching really is so important. And so, and you have to teach it over and over and over again and really reinforce it. So I think it's very important to let patients know that it's not a small impact. It's a huge impact if they make significant lifestyle changes. So, you know, smoking, obesity, excess alcohol intake, red meat, the lack of fruits and vegetables and dietary fiber, stuff we all know, being sedentary, all these things that people could actually do something about if they don't have the money to buy all our expensive herbal nutraceutical protocols or get IV therapies, they can still reduce their risk and teach their children how to have less risk. So I think it's really important. And so there's a lot of really good information there. All right. So I'm going to go on to this really great case that Ava produced. Is it Eva or Ava? I think it must be Eva. So this is an interesting case, but I also want to say that the case study submission gets uploaded along with my notes. And this is an example of a very thorough and thoughtful case study submission that has an incredible amount of detail to show kind of the thinking of the clinician who's presenting this case for feedback. So it helps me to mentor you a lot. So thank you very much. It's Anna. I'm so sorry. It's Anna. So, and Anna, you're in Canada, I believe. And you're a nurse, and it looks like maybe you're a homeopath also. I don't know what all those letters are. All right, so this is a slim, possibly sarcopenic patient, woman, 47-year-old female, married of Croatian ethnicity. She's a taxi owner and a taxi driver, and she has resected stage 2 colorectal cancer, has had chemotherapy, is concerned about recurrence. And Anna notes that she's had a lot of dental work done with a lot of mercury fillings that she had removed. She's been a smoker and wants to quit. Says there's not really any trauma in her life. But you know what I think about when there's Eastern Europeans? I think about toxic exposures. You know, it depends what time of her life and how long she lived in Eastern Europe. But there's like no environmental controls over there. And a lot of people who spent a significant amount of their life living in Eastern Europe often have had heavy metals exposures. A lot of the exposures that happen in, you know, in the industrial world, solvents and things. So I always consider that. And what's interesting in this case, it seems that this patient also has poor detoxification function because she had more adverse reactions to the chemo than many other patients. And this patient had, for example, she had two cycles of capecitabine and oxaliplatin, and she had terrible colitis and neuropathy. And so some patients only have mild. So, you know, you have to look at all of that. When anybody's on 5-FU or capecitabine, which is also called Xeloda, I also think about when they have like unusually toxic reactions or their cell counts really crash, then you can do a genetic test on them to see if they have a SNP for cimetalate synthase, I think is the enzyme. But those are the patients that get really bad toxic reactions and really crashed cell counts from 5-FU and Xeloda capecitabine. And then there is, of course, a subset of patients who also have trouble with the platinum drugs. Here in the States, they give prednisone and Benadryl with the infusion so that patients don't have so much inflammation. But of course, the capecitabine being a microtubule inhibitor will just break down the lining of the gastrointestinal tract. And so some people are going to be more sensitive to that. Remember, we want to really make sure our patients have a healthy microbiome to help them have a little more resistance to that. The other thing about this patient is she was diagnosed under 50. And so I didn't see anywhere in her records whether she was checked for Lynch syndrome. But in the States, typically if there's a patient under 50 who's diagnosed with colorectal cancer, they are assessed for Lynch syndrome, which is a hereditary non-polyposis form of colorectal cancer, but it also it gives risk for endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, stomach cancer, small intestine, hepatobiliary, urinary tract, brain, skin cancers are more common with this syndrome. So I didn't see that in the records you sent. That means doesn't mean it wasn't done, but it should be done. You know, it should be done as a routine part when patients diagnosed young, because it helps us to follow them more appropriately and to understand that they have lots of other risks. The more you understand the risk factors of your patients, the better. On the treatment plan, I put a few things. So I really, let me just say that Anna put together a great treatment plan based on her own experience and knowledge, as well as things that I use. And I was very, very impressed with the thoroughness of your thinking about what to do with the patient. So as a mentoring role, I want to just bring a few other things to your attention. So the things that I put on my notes, the things I think are the most important that included things you're doing, and then I put in bold some things to consider either in higher doses or to add in. So one of the things, there's a lot of studies on baby aspirin and colorectal cancer occurrence and recurrence. It's pretty compelling. I'll generally put a patient on a baby aspirin who has a history of colorectal cancer because it's pretty compelling research. But if there's a contraindication, like if she still has colitis or if she's having any microscopic bleeding, you wouldn't want to do that. But it's something to consider in colorectal cancer patients. There are some studies that show that cimetidine, which is an over-the-counter antacid protein pump inhibitor, it's called Tagamet in the United States, 800 milligrams a day show that it has an impact on colorectal cancer prevention. And Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who is an integrative oncologist, medical doctor in Boca Raton, Florida, uses this a lot with lots of patients, not just with his colorectal patients. He's like really big on doing it, but he's very drug oriented. He doesn't know anything about herbs, so he goes to things like this, but he uses it in a lot of his patients. He thinks it's important. COX-2 inhibition is important in these patients. That's where the aspirin comes in. But also you can think about omega-3 fatty acids, curcumin, tocotrienol, boswellia, which I added, right, which I added in there. There are some studies that shows that some of the statins, the more lipophilic ones like simvastatin, are associated with a lower risk of colorectal cancer. And so, you know, I'm not closed-minded to the whole toolbox, so I'm going to educate you in that way, because maybe you have a patient who says, I want to get off my statins, but they have a history of colorectal cancer. You might want to say, well, you might want to stay on them if your liver's okay. If we're looking for natural statins, we look to red yeast rice. A therapeutic dose is generally about 4 caps. Most of the caps are about 250 to 500 milligrams. So to see what you have there. So those are things to think about, you know, to fill some gaps in a treatment plan. And also depending on the finances of your patient, baby aspirin is pretty inexpensive and high compliance. Again, tocotrienols have a really strong place, I feel, in this setting. And there's a product by Designs for Health that has Nigella seed oil in it as well, which is black cumin seed oil, which also is very, very powerful source. It's a source of thymoquinone, which is particularly useful, for example, in inhibition of pancreatic cancer and other gastrointestinal cancers. So think about tocotrienols. Think also about this nice combination product. In pancreatic cancer patients, I give them big doses of Nigella seed oil because the thymoquinone has really good studies, good human studies, and it's also synergistic with Gemzar, so you can give it concurrently with patients who are on Gemzar. I like to use Hinokiol quite a lot. You noted that this patient was anxious, so Hinokiol has a sedative anti-anxiety effect. But it also has an impact in the PI3K/AKT pathway. And so it's one of my favorite phytochemicals. And there is a clinical pearl in which I lectured on that. And so I'll give the last dose of that at bedtime because it also helps people sleep. You had Broncoprotect in there. I really like to use Boswellia, particularly where there's a high concentration of the alpha-keto boswellic acids. There's a lot of studies on Boswellia and inflammatory bowel disease, colitis, and colorectal cancers. And so it tends to work more in the lower bowel than the upper GI. I also would give a very high dose of curcumin in this setting. So maybe 2 grams twice a day to give a, you know, 4 grams a day dose. Similarly, I'd give a high more therapeutic dose of the EGCG. And I always put the omega-3 fatty acids in also at a relatively high dose and putting them in at 2 grams twice a day here, like berberine, like oil of oregano. I also put in the artemisinin into this protocol and notice that I use it 1 week on, 1 week off, 1 week on, 1 week off to pulse it so you don't get resistance. And because this patient had colitis, I don't know if she still does, then we want to think about repairing the GI lining, and glutamine is a good first choice for that. And then because we think she had, I think she has impaired detoxification, you would put her on some, looks like lipotrophic kind of liver formulas. So I'm just suggesting that you take a look at the Designs for Health Detox Antiox formula. I like it quite a lot. And then I would add more N-acetylcysteine because she's had also not only detox issues, but a lot of oxidative stress with all the inflammatory reactions that she's had. And then milk thistle also ends up being a multitasker there, supporting liver detoxification function, having some anti-tumor activity, but also being super anti-inflammatory. So those are just some tweaks I would make in the supplements. I also like to use high doses of melatonin at bedtime. There are studies on colorectal cancer and melatonin. I start people at 10 milligrams, but remember most of the studies are at 20. You can give people melatonin up to the dose where they get vivid dreams. And if they like the vivid dreams, they can stay on that dose. If they don't, they can back off a little bit. I would also, of course, in any resected patient and any patient who's had chemotherapy, especially oral chemotherapy like Xeloda, really work on her microbiome and put in, you know, high doses of probiotics. We'll say Designs for Health has just come out with three new probiotics that are super high potency. And so they have one course of treatment that comes as a 14-day treatment, little packets of 250 billion organisms. So if I do a stool test on someone and there's no growth of lactobacillus or bifidus, then you have to, number one, increase butyrate and the short-chain fatty acids, which are the substrate and the fuel for those organisms. But also then you might want to inoculate the gut with really, really high doses, but you have to make sure there's an environment in which they can flourish. So you might want to take a look at those new products that just come out in this last month. And then in that same vein, we'd want to put some prebiotics in there. So the Saccharomyces boulardii is great. And then the PaleoFiber product by Designs for Health is a great product for providing the substrate for the probiotics to flourish and for increasing butyrate. So that's, you know, you have to rebuild the gut. And then maybe you'll get rid of some of the inflammatory reactions. But there's a history here of C. difficile. So I don't know if you can get this product in Canada, but in the States, there's a live probiotic called BioK. And it is the only probiotic that I know of that's been studied in the hospital setting for C. difficile. And so I just have people take it if they're going to the hospital. I'll have them take some before they go and take it while they're there if they're not restricted orally. And certainly if they contract C. difficile. And then you want to, again, think about things like Boswellia that dial down the inflammation in the GI tract, and also the glutamine. Like, I just start with simple things. You have to see what somebody tolerates. But if someone's going in for any surgery, there are studies that show that repleting patients with probiotics not only prevents them from getting hospital-borne C. difficile infections, but it also prevents all kinds of other infections and complications of surgery because they have better inflammatory control, they have more immune regulation, and they have more B vitamins to metabolize drugs. So think about pre and post-op really repleting patients with probiotics. And then, you know, if you can get BioK, then I always give that before somebody goes to the hospital, always. So those are, you know, some high altitude kind of tweaks and specific tweaks as well, some, you know, ways I think about it. And then I also put together some herbal tonics and some long-term ideas for you. So I made an herbal tonic recipe that I would, you know, I compound these sort of things in my clinic. I'm sure there's people that do that in Canada too, with some really powerful immune support, the astragalus and ganoderma formula. And then minobuferm is a great companion formula that really keeps liver function and inflammation in the GI tract healthy and good bile flow. And then I put in things like polygonatum, which helps with promoting apoptosis, the salvia. In a patient like this, we want to think about fibrosis as a risk factor just because of the resection. The Oldenlandia is a source of ursalic acid, which has anti-tumor properties. The scutellarias, particularly the bicalensis, very rich in berberine. Also the green tea. And then magnolia bark is a nice Chinese herb to put in GI formulas because it removes obstructions in the gastrointestinal tract functionally. It improves peristalsis, and it also is put in formulas for with solid masses, and it is the source of Hinokiol also. So I'll put that in. It also is high in ursolic acid, which is a very powerful phytochemical for anti-tumor activity. Fuling pea is a fungus that grows on the roots of trees that's very good for inflammation in the GI tract. It also has some anti-tumor properties because it's rich in polysaccharides and the way other fungi like Ganoderma and Coriolis are. And then tangerine peel has some anti-tumor properties, but I put it in here for digestive reasons. And then licorice root is added to almost all Chinese formulas to harmonize them. And that's just an ancient idea. I can't tell you the science behind it, but I am faithful to that in many of my formulas. So a formula like this, a person could take long term, right, to really push back on any recurrence. And this patient's primary concern. And, you know, it's a young patient. So we think, well, we want to keep her alive for another 50 years. What are we going to do? So I always put something like this in for at least the first 2 years after they have completed their treatment. And then if you look at the last page, I have put, think about IV therapies. Also think about, actually, there's two more pages. There's think about IV therapies, and I, put things to consider. You could think about using cannabinoids in this patient. Patients with high risk of recurrence, sometimes oral low-dose naltrexone is useful, inhibits proliferation. It's a low-dose use of off-label use of a drug used in higher doses for other purposes. You can't use naltrexone. Somebody's on opioids. And then you asked me about biomarkers also, Anna. So this is what I would order and track in this patient. So what you want to do is, the routine things like the CBC with differential so that you can watch the neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. Currently, she's a 1.0, so her prognosis is good based on this biomarker. You just want to do a comprehensive metabolic panel so you can watch her kidney and liver function and her minerals and her electrolytes. And, you can run a CA19-9 on her. There's a typo there, actually. You can do a CEA on her. Whatever the handholds are, you can look back and see what has and hasn't been ordered. I always like to get a baseline after somebody's finished their treatment. And I'll track their inflammation markers like CRP. I often put ESR in there, SED rate. I always like to watch the lactic acid dehydrogenase because that can be, in some patients, evidence of metabolic activity, microscopic metabolic tumor activity. The GGPT, I always do in somebody who's had chemo just to see if their toxic load is showing. Of course, we will follow liver function tests in this patient. Remember, where do colorectal cancer metastasize? Right through the hepatic portal vein, right to the liver. So that's where you see the most metastasis in these types of cancers, because it doesn't have to, it has a whole freeway to take the cells right there. So that's where you get the most metastasis and the most threat to life. If you have metastatic lesions in your liver, which is a organ that does over 400 chemical reactions for us, and it gets out of commission, that leads to death. So next call, I'm going to talk about how to talk to patients about end of life and mortality, because in the last several months, I've had those conversations with people. And what made me think about it here is I had a patient who had severe metastasis to her liver from breast cancer, not from colorectal cancer, and was really cachectic and sarcopenic, and called me to see if there was any, she asked me, do you have any miracles? And I ended up, I looked at her, she looked, extremely, she was really thin and cachectic, but, her eyes were bright yellow, her liver stopped functioning, her physician had put her into hospice, but the physician didn't say, well, now you have to prepare for your end of life. They just write the hospice order. So, and that's not to say that people go into remission, come out of hospice, but in her case, she was in liver failure. And so, somebody had to say to her, spend time with people you love. So I'm going to talk about how I talk to patients about that. And then some more experienced physicians, maybe like you, Stacey, can chime in too, how you talk to your patients. But I think it's necessary for the patient to have someone to talk to. So you watch for liver metastasis in a colorectal patient like this. Anyone who's had a solid tumor, you watch their copper and their cellular plasmin, and then consider oral copper chelation to keep them NED if you can. Shoot for a zinc to copper ratio that's at least 1:1. I watch ferritin as another marker of inflammation. And you can, you know, of course, any cancer where people might bleed, like colorectal cancer, you might see their iron counts change. You know, if you're following them closely and you have a lot of data points, you'll see trend, and that's more meaningful than one data point. And then we will, of course, watch for hypercoagulation, which can be an early microscopic sign of tumor activity. Watch the hemoglobin A1C in terms of making sure the person isn't hyperglycemic and hyperinsulinemic. And then also IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, is a pretty significant growth factor in many cancer patients. And so I like to watch that in all patients. And I'm going to make a lecture on biomarkers for you guys so that you have more than these case studies to hear how I think about it. And then because of her toxic reactions to the drugs, I'd like to know about her methylation and detoxification SNPs. So she could do 23andMe, or she could do a Genova detoxigenomics panel and look at, you know, maybe we could figure out how to protect her more if we know some of her SNPs. And then, of course, I, in a patient like this, I do a stool and digestive analysis to make sure we know what we need to do for her microbiome. And she might consider intermittent fasting. Of course, she'd do, you know, kind of the outsmart cancer diet being low carb. She could do Walter Longo's 5-day-a-month fast, modified fast. Walter Longo is a researcher on modified fasting and cancer and longevity. And then on the last page are, you know, just lifestyle things we teach our patients. But the very last thing is this sort of cytotoxic seasonal herbal therapy plus IV therapy that I spoke about earlier when we were talking about IV therapy. So this is an example of something I have people do every season. And I, if they have high risk for recurrence, I have them do it 4 times a year for 2 weeks, 4 times a year. And I just have them think about the equinoxes and the solstices as a way to remember to do it. And then I have in my reminder calendars for my patients, they all get a reminder at this before the solstice and before the equinox to remember to do these therapies. So I'll put together like a cytotoxic herbal therapy, such as listed here, and then give the artemisinin in, see if they could do IV therapies concurrently, see if they could do hyperbaric oxygen concurrently, and just have a way to pulse something that would scavenge any cells. And remember that for stem cells, we're doing a lot of botanicals on a daily basis as well, like resveratrol and curcumin and EGCG from green tea all have an impact on cancer stem cells. So this is a really comprehensive treatment plan to show you all the things you can think about. Do you have to do all the things in this treatment plan? No, you don't. But you can look at this as a way to pick the things that you think are the biggest lever for a patient. This person is a taxi driver, so obviously she can't afford this unless she owns the taxi company. But some of my patients do all of this because they can afford to. So you have to pick what the biggest levers are and what your patient will do as well, will be compliant with. And then as they see better results, as their quality of life improves, as their cancer terrain improves, then they may have more motivation to do more. So, you know, patients go on a big learning and developmental curve when they're faced with their mortality. So I will stop there, and then Anna, please feel free to unmute yourself and ask questions, and anybody else, because this is really a great case, gave me an opportunity to show you everything that you could think about in a case. So press *7 if you want to talk. Yes.
Anybody
Hi, there? Stacey
again.
Hi, Stacey.
Hi. So one thing with the colon cancer patients that I really stress is exercise.
Uh-huh.
Because like a ton of studies have shown an enormous risk reduction. In fact, the risk reduction from exercise is greater than chemotherapy.
Especially
in a stage two patient.
Uh-huh.
So a stage two patient, many times they don't even need chemotherapy.
Right.
Like only, you know, like, well, I run Oncotype on the stage twos to see,
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
do they really even, are they going to benefit from it? And most of them don't.
Right.
So, I really, really try to get them to hit the exercise, and we have programs here where they can join a special program to get on a exercise program, get them motivated with other patients, and it really is awesome. So people are motivated at this point to do that, and I think
yes,
it's really
they are.
Important.
Yeah, a stage two patient could think of never recurring, right? So if you get it right for them. And so there's a subset of patients you feel can decline chemo and just have a resection. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, for stage two? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So then No, go ahead. Go ahead.
For stage three, that's a little different. It depends on...
You guys see. Yeah.
Yeah. Stage three, it depends on how many lymph nodes are involved. How big was the tumor? What grade was the tumor?
Right,
mostly
right.
lymph nodes, though. So
right,
the lymph node
right.
status, to
right.
me, is the most important risk
right,
factor.
Right. Well, then you assume they have systemic disease, right?
Correct.
So then you need a systemic therapy.
Right. So I would highly recommend it for all stage three patients. And either it's the standard of care now is either FOLFOX, so 5-FU and oxaliplatin for 6 months, or if you're over 70, there really doesn't seem to be much benefit from the oxaliplatin. So Xeloda or capecitabine is perfectly
uh-huh.
fine for someone
uh-huh.
who's older.
Uh-huh. And preserves some quality of life for them.
Absolutely, because oxaliplatin is rough.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
And it only provides a small part of the risk reduction.
Uh-huh.
The 5-FU is by far the most important part of the
uh-huh.
plan.
Uh-huh. You know, the other cancer that I'm aware of where the studies are pretty compelling on exercise are breast cancer.
Yes. Yeah,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I put this reference paper in here about lifestyle, because I really want to encourage everyone to have some kind of patient teaching on these lifestyle factors, which are huge levers, not small impact, huge impact. All right, everyone, we're just a little bit, 7 minutes over, but if anybody else wants to ask a question, I'll stay on the call. And everyone, thank you so much. There's people from everywhere on this call. This is just fabulous. So thank you, everyone, for showing up. We got states all over the country and Canada represented here. All right. Looks like nobody else wants to ask a question. So I thank you all for your attention and participation. Let's get another good case for the next call. And submit your questions and any case, because there's a little less time between this call and the next one. So I will see you all in a couple of weeks. Thank you, everyone. Good night.